Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and writer behind Game Wisdom. We have a great cast for you tonight. My guest is the founder behind Mohawk Games, and his previous credits include being the lead designer behind Civilization IV. Please welcome to the cast, Soren Johnson.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going pretty great, Soren. How's everything with you?
We're doing great. It's been a pretty exciting week for us.
Yep, I know. The game that you're currently working on, Off-World Trading Company, recently went into early access, and we'll be talking about that probably in a few minutes.
Yep, that's right.
So, to get things rolling, for people who may not have heard of you and your studio before, could you give us a little introduction about yourself and Mohawk Games?
Sure. Well, I've been in the games industry for, I guess, about 15 years now. Mm-hmm. I got my start at Firaxis Games, which is Sid Meier's studio that, you know, focuses mostly on strategy games. Mm-hmm. So I was hired essentially to be a gameplay AI programmer on Civ 3, but I ended up also co-designing that game. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I went to be the lead designer and again gameplay programmer on Civ 4. That was a project I was pretty happy with. Mm-hmm. From there, I left Firaxis in 2007, and then I went to work at EA for about 4 years. The two games I worked on there that were public were Spore, which I kind of helped to finish, and then mm-hmm. Dragon Age Legends, which was actually a Facebook RPG. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I founded Mohawk in, 2011. Mm-hmm. We've been working on Off-World Trading Company. It's our first game, the only one we've been working on. Our studio is, we got about 7 people. Full-time people in it right now, and mm-hmm. mostly we're veterans of the Baltimore game companies, which means there's got a few people from Firaxis, some people in Big Huge Games, some people from Ziga East, mm-hmm. but you know, we're all people who for the most part trace our lineage back to the games Sid works on.
Cool. And I'm a big fan of Big Huge Games. I mean, we could have a 2-hour discussion on Rise of Nations easily.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, we've got a guy, our UI programmer is basically the UI programmer from Rise of Nations, actually.
Oh, man. I mean, one of the things I keep saying is how much I love the UI for Rise of Nations. So mm-hmm. I would definitely love to pick his brain for a few hours.
Yeah. Well, he's doing a great job, and he'd be a plenty of good experience. So.
Awesome. So I know we're going to talk about Off-World Trading Company in a few minutes, but my first question for you then, Soren, is since you work on Civ 4 now at Off-World Trading Company, the strategy genre as a whole has really changed over the last, 5-6 years, maybe even longer than that.
Right.
So for you, how has, I guess, your design philosophy or your sense of strategy game design has evolved since your time at Firaxis to where you are now at Mohawk?
Well, I think that going through the Civ series, that whole process itself changed my design philosophy a lot. Mm-hmm. In that, I think when I started, I joined Firaxis to work on Civ 3, and I was very excited about that. Civ's a game that has a great topic, mm-hmm. all of world history, and it's also a topic that is really hard to fit together into a whole cohesive design.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, there's a lot of parts that Civ that actually don't fit together completely. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, it's the benefits of the theme outweigh the downsides of trying to make a game that makes sense with spearmen and then also with aircraft carriers. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a real source of tension within if you're a Civ designer. Mm-hmm. So I'd say going forward from there, now when I look at making a new strategy game, I'm trying to look at making games that have the right scope.
Mm-hmm.
The game itself has a sort of cohesive feel. It doesn't go on longer than it should. Mm-hmm. All the parts of the game are relevant. Those are a lot of things that I think about. And with Off-World, the games themselves last about 30 minutes long. That's actually surprised a lot of people because they're kind of expecting a tycoon game. And so the surprise, it goes so quickly. But that's because we originally had a game that lasted much longer, but we kept pairing out all the elements of the game mm-hmm. that were not really all that interesting. And, we're just kind of like these rote processes and we kind of forced the play to focus on just the important parts. And that allowed us to really narrow down the game time to half an hour, which has a lot of big, good benefits. It means that, you know, multiplayer is very viable because the sessions are short.
Yeah.
It also means that you can have games that have a lot more randomness, or sorry, not necessarily just pure randomness, but just that you can have a lot more variability in a game, because it's kind of the effect that you see in games like Super Meat Boy or Spelunky, in that you can have a certain amount of craziness because the games aren't necessarily that long. You know, whereas if you have a game that is going on for 20 hours and then it suddenly ends arbitrarily, you know, off of this crazy event, you know, it's hard because people have invested more and more time into it. So if you have a shorter game, you have a lot more design flexibility.
And really good point about the multiplayer. I know I tried playing a game of Civ 5 with a friend last year, and once you get like 3-4 hours into it, it just becomes very hard to keep that momentum going. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of competitive and micromanagement-focused strategy games have really risen in popularity, because, as you said, Soren, when your game's only like a 20-30-minute match, it has a lot more room for making that a very tense or very exciting 30 minutes, and then you can just go play another game and another game and so on.
Yeah, it's tough. The multiplayer Civ is the game that, like, everyone kind of thinks in their head that they want to play, but then once they sit down to play, they see that there's, you know, a lot of difficulties involved. You know, we really put a lot of effort in Civ 4 into making that, like, the best version of multiplayer that Civ could be, but at the end of the day, we're still kind of, like, paddling upstream, you know, whereas with Offworld, like, we're really, you know, accepting that as one of the constraints of the process of the project, is that we really want to make sure that this game is fun multiplayer. And, you know, so because of that, like, the session length just sort of naturally flows from that.
Yeah. Now, I want to go back to what you just said a moment ago, so regarding the abstraction in strategy games, because this is a really big factor for game design of these titles, because, again, when you're playing a game like Civilization, as you said, it's a game of all these different systems and aesthetics and time periods that come together, and you can't really fit all that in. The classic, you know, tanks versus spearman quandary that comes into play. And part of the reason for, like, the level of abstraction we see in strategy games is the fact that a lot of strategy games and a lot of really high-level design comes from board game inspiration or creating a paper prototype and stuff like that. With your design style and with Offworld Train Company itself, have you done, like, paper prototyping or translating board game rules to a PC audience in design?
Yeah, real early on, just at the very, very beginning, we did kind of, like, sketch out, you know, the way the game was going to look, and, you know, kind of, like, put some pieces on the board and move them around. But, you know, ironically, that I wouldn't say that really contributed too much to the game that is actually playable right now. And it is kind of strange, because actually one of the very common comments about Offworld is people are like, wow, this feels like a board game, you know, like, it, you know, like this, you know, this, you know, they say it just has this board game feel, even though it's a, you know, it's an RTS, you know, it's a game that would be absolutely impossible to do as a board game. And I think the reason for that is that we really put a lot of emphasis on simple rules and transparency in the game design itself. The game itself is not actually all that complicated. You know, it's mostly just, you know, here's a bunch of buildings, and you put one unit of water into a farm, and, you know, half a unit of food comes out the other end, right? Like, that's kind of the core of a lot of these rules. Or, you know, you have the market. You know, the rule is simply every time you buy something, the price goes up, and every time you sell, the price goes down. You know, it's just a lot of really simple, transparent stuff. And so in that sense, like, I think we're trying to, you know, kind of very much adhere to the spirit of board games, which I think is sort of a spirit of transparency. You know, it's kind of like you see the engine running in front of you. You know, I think that's one of the big appeal of board game.
Yeah. And really good point regarding that, all that feel, that almost like one-to-one of seeing the action and then having the result be very transparent to the player. That's one of the issues that we see with a lot of very complex or high-level thinking 4X-style games, like Crusader Kings, Europa Universalis, where you're making these choices, but then you're never really shown the consequence of that action. It's all hidden under the layers, under the numbers. But with a game like Off-World Train Company, as you said, it's all very much, you know, hard numbers, hard value. I put a farm down, one unit of water goes in, half a unit of food comes out. And, you know, these are very simple numbers, something that you can easily grasp, and it allows you to make those very complicated and interesting decisions.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very important philosophical decision you make when you design the game, whether you're going to go down sort of the transparent path or the, you know, non-transparent one. Mm-hmm. Because certainly that's absolutely true about those Paradox games is, you know, they give you a lot of numbers, but you know, even if they told you all the rules, there would still be, it would still be almost impossible to understand how they fit together. But they absolutely definitely do not tell you all the rules for how all this stuff works. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say there's kind of a split among strategy games. There's ones that kind of adhere more to like board game transparency philosophy. Mm-hmm. And then the Paradox games, they're really in many ways more simulations, you know, than games, so to speak. Mm-hmm. In that, you know, over time, you know, you'll get a sense of, you know, how it works and you'll start making better decisions. But you're playing, you know, in a very sort of intuitive way, and you're never quite sure exactly what's going on. And I think different players kind of gravitate to different types of games. I think there's people who prefer transparency, mm-hmm. and then there's people who prefer sort of simulations because of, you know, all of the complexity there.
Yeah,
and I think it's good to like know up front what type of game you're making, because that has a number of ramifications for, you know, how the mechanics work and how mm-hmm. the UI works and your relationship to the player and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and as you said a few minutes ago, when you were distilling Off-World down to like 30-minute chunks of play, having that core foundation be the center of your title is a very important almost thought process or a design philosophy that I've spoken to a lot of other developers about. I've spoken with Chris Park and John Schaefer, who of course also make strategy games, and they said the same thing about how important that distillation is of what your core mechanic is. Because if that doesn't work or it's not easy to explain, all that just, you know, flows downhill and it's going to affect all the aspects of your design.
Yep. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Now, before we talk more about Off-World, there's one design question or strategy question that I really want to ask you, Sword. And that is, the strategy genre has definitely had an interesting turn over the last decade, maybe a little bit more than that. We've seen, you know, the rise of competitive games. We've seen developers try to go for the almost CCG or MMO style RTS. And the genre has really, I'm not sure if it's completely gone, but it's definitely shrunk since Civ 4 came out in 2005. So my question for you, Soren, is, in your opinion, what do you think about sort of the tracking the strategy genre over like the last decade? Like, how has it turned out for you and the people that you've worked with?
Well, I think strategy games have kind of struggled with the growth of game budgets and mm-hmm. The growth of game teams and the, you know, kind of the general graphical and production arm race. Mm-hmm. Strategy games, you know, they want to have good graphics, but like once someone gets 10, 20 hours into a game, like the graphics are not what they're there
yeah.
for, right? And so, you know, there's probably a number of, you know, sort of AAA action adventure type games that, you know, kind of like really survive purely on their graphics, just because mm-hmm. you know, in 10 hours the player is gonna be done with the game, and you know, if it looked good enough, maybe they had a good experience, but that's mm-hmm. that's not how it's gonna, you know, that doesn't work for strategy games.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, the issue is, at the same time, like if you're a AAA publisher or developer and you decide to make a strategy game, you still feel like you need to compete with the other AAA games. So you're going to be putting a lot of, you know, you're going to be hiring a lot of artists, 3D programmers, and, you know, that's going to cost a lot of money. And so now that you're spending a lot of money on this project, you know, you're like, well, we could do this off, you know, we could do this, you know, crazy design idea, like, for example, make an economic RTS, or we could make, you know, essentially what you'd make is another Total War game or another StarCraft game or another Civ mm-hmm. game, right? Those are basically your options. We could make a game that, you know, or it has to be very much like that. It has to be a game where there's a proven track record. Where, like, mm-hmm. we know there's another game like this that has sold 2 or 3 million copies
yeah.
because, you know, the hard thing about something like Off-World is like, okay, economic RTS, well, we don't know what the ceiling is for that game, right?
Yeah.
Like, even if we execute perfectly with the game. Like, it's possible that there's only so many people out there who are interested in buying that type of game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, at least with, you know, StarCraft or Civ, you know that that potential audience is out there. And so what mm-hmm. that means is that the people who are deciding what strategy game projects to fund are getting really, really conservative.
Yeah.
And I think that that conservative nature has sort of killed off a lot of the sort of the not as big franchises mm-hmm. In the strategy game space. So now, you know, besides a few of these sort of you know, colossi that I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. like it's been basically now taken over by you know, independent developers, more or less.
Yeah.
You know, so people like Stardock and Paradox, and, you know, although these companies are actually quite large by the standards of 15 or 20 years ago, mm-hmm. by today's standards, they're considered pretty small, but they're the, you know, the sort of the giants of strategy games.
Yeah. And it's a really good point about how the strategy genre doesn't really lend itself to the same AAA appeal as you would a first-person shooter, online multiplayer, etc. I think part of that is the fact that every strategy game, or at least the ones that people hold up the highest, are very much completely different games each time. You can't really compare Civilization to Europa Universalis as the same way you can't compare StarCraft to Total War. While they're all, you know, part of the strategy genre, they're completely different beasts.
Right.
And it makes it really hard to get an established fan base because, as you said, someone who may like Europa Universalis style of abstraction, hiding all those numbers, may not love, you know, someone else's game. But it's really hard to get that the established fan base, as you would, like, when you say, you know, someone likes Call of Duty, they're going to probably like Battlefield and et cetera.
Right. It may, yeah, I mean, you know, you make Halo, and then you're like, well, okay, we can make Destiny, but it's not, you know, you're not making some completely radical different type of game.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. It's a big problem for strategy games.
Yeah. And that's a two-hour topic right there, so we better stop it right there before we start blabbing on about that.
Yep.
Now, one other question, or two other questions I just want to ask you briefly about, Soren. As we just said regarding how the strategy genre has shifted towards smaller, and even in some cases more competitive-oriented games, I was just wondering, as a strategy game designer yourself, what are your thoughts on that shift? Do you like the faster, micro-oriented strategy games, or do you prefer more of the larger-scale Civilization or even Europa Universalis style?
I mean, I tend to gravitate towards the smaller scale games at this point, ones that I feel like get a complete experience in an hour or two. But mm-hmm. a lot of that has to do with simply the amount of gaming time I have myself personally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I'm a pretty busy guy, and beyond that, I think as a game designer, I need to expose myself to a lot of games. So I tend to, you know, sample a whole lot of games for a few hours, you know, which means that, you know, I'm only ever going to be able to play a game like Crusader Kings so much, right?
Yeah.
Actually, there's a lot of things I like about that game, but I just cannot devote the amount of time necessary to really get all there is to get out of that game. It's interesting. You mentioned John Schaefer before because, mm-hmm. you know, maybe it's just the way our brains are wired. He's the exact opposite. like he's probably put like 1,000 hours in Splunky and, you know,
oh, yeah.
hundreds of hours at least into a lot of the Paradox games. Maybe he also samples games like I do, but I think he has more of like, he goes for depth with a few specific games as opposed to, you know, breadth with, you know, trying to touch a lot of games.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a fan of the podcast. We definitely need to set like having both of you on at some point, but then I'm afraid that could be like a 7-8 hour podcast with all the talks we would have.
Yeah.
Okay. So with that, let's move on and talk more about Off-World Trading Company, because I know you're a very busy guy. I don't want to keep you too long. So, with Off-World Trading Company, as we've talked about over the last few minutes, it is an economic-focused strategy game. So, for people who haven't been paying too much attention to it, could you give us a little bit more detail about what is it about?
Sure. So, it's an RTS in the sense that it kind of fits the format, which means, you know, you can play up to eight. Play with like up to eight people. You know, the games last about 30 minutes. You know, it's obviously very strategic. It works good in team play. It also works actually very well in free for all.
Mm-hmm.
And it has strong single player play versus the AI. It's good in multiplayer. So it hits all those sort of check boxes for an RTS. But the core mechanic that there's no real military in the game. There's no units. You can't select units. Mm-hmm. You can't go attack the other guy. The core mechanics are instead all the type of mechanics you would see in like a Tycoon game, where there's you know, there's 13 different resources and there's a resource tree of how they're all related to each other. In the background, there's this open free market where you can buy and sell any resource you want to, and the prices you know, changes dynamically on, you know, how the players are doing, what the players are deciding to do. And then finally, there's a stock market as well, where you're sort of buying shares in your competitors, and that's ultimately how you win the game, is not by, you know, destroying someone, but by basically buying them out on the stock market.
And as we talked about, because the game is kept to 20-30 minute matches, there's a lot of room for random events or variables to mess with things. Could you talk a little bit more about some of the things that make each play a different beast?
Sure. So the maps are randomly generated, which is something I've always wished more RTS games had. So it was one of the nice things about the Ensemble games is the, you know, Age of Empires and Age of Mythology, they always had random maps, which is great. But yeah, we have, you know, random maps, so get random terrain, but then on top of that, you also get a random distribution of resources on top of that terrain, which means, like, where there's five base resources in the game: water, iron, aluminum, silicon, and carbon. And you find them, you know, the very beginning of the game, you're actually exploring the map, looking for these resources, and sometimes you'll see, like, a high source of it, sometimes you'll see a low source of it. Some maps might have a whole lot of water, some maps might have almost no water, some maps have an even distribution of resources, some maps have a very uneven one. You know, all the iron might be out on the east side of the map, and all of the water might be on the west side, which also changes things. So, you know, every game you play, you know, you're discovering this new map and trying to figure out a specific strategy for that map. On top of that, you know, a lot of RTS games have different factions, right? It's very standard. In you know, StarCraft, that means, you know, you're going to be the Terrans or the Zerg or the Protoss. For us, there's four, basically. There's Expansive, Robotic, Scavenger, Scientific, and they all have various bonuses, essentially. You know, the Robotic, for example, they don't need life support. But the thing that's really different is, in Offworld, you choose your faction after the game begins. You don't choose it in the lobby. You know, instead, the game begins, and you start scanning, and you look around, and then you decide, you know, do I want to be Expansive, or do I want to be Scavenger? Scavenger, for example, they don't use iron and steel for their buildings, they use carbon. So if they find a good source of carbon on the map, if the player finds a good source of carbon on the map, they may want to go Scavenger. So those really important player decisions also affect then what the other players are going to do. You know, if I see a bunch of players go Expansive, then maybe I'll go Scientific, right? Like, I might, you know, make a different decision based off of the decision the other players make. And then the game begins, and then the resource market appears, and prices start going up and down. And so there are, you know, it's not necessarily randomness that it changes based off of the player decisions, but that is, you know, sometimes hard to predict. But then there's also random events in the game, basically surplus and shortage. So, you know, every so often you'll hear a sound, and then you'll see food shortage, and that means the prices, you know, are going to be on its way up. And then you might see steel surplus, which means the prices goes down. And then there are other type of sort of persistent events, like there might be a dust storm, and that means that, you know, the wind turbines are going to perform better and the solar panels are going to perform worse. So you have all of these factors going on that, you know, sort of gives the market a different feel each game. You know, where like one game you play, you're like, wow, the price of glass was so high that game. And another game you play, it's like, wow, glass was so cheap. What happened? Why was that?
Now, one interesting mechanic that I want to ask you about, Soren, is the fact that, as we said, you can begin the game as one of these different factions, and each one sort of leans towards different resources or different items. As you said, robotics have a focus on electronics. The scavengers do more carbon. So having these different, or I would say essentially pre-made factions at the start, how's your general play flow change based on the map if between one time you play as robotics versus a second time you play as robotics?
So you're asking, like, if...
How does someone's, like, strategy or their decisions change if they're playing as, like, the same faction on one map versus they're playing as the same faction on another design map or another randomly generated map?
Well, it kind of depends upon what the resources you get. I mean, there's a certain distribution of resources on the map, but then also you have a limited number of claims, right? So when you start the game, you might have four or five claims or something like that. It depends upon the difficulty level. What that means is you have to commit to a certain set of resources. So, you know, there's 13 resources in the game, and you're not going to be able to produce all of them, right? Because you have, say, four claims, right? So, okay, I'm going to claim some water. Fine. Then I'm going to claim some. Then maybe I'll build a farm. That's my second claim. Then I'll build a metal mine on some iron. That's my third. And then I'll build a steel mill. That's my fourth. And like, okay, great. And then like, wait, well, I don't have any more claims. So what about power? What about oxygen? What about aluminum? What about glass? You know, your goal is going to be short of your needs. And so, you know, that's going to that's going to affect, how you're going to go out. And it's one thing to say, like, well, I have a certain path I go to, but maybe there's only one high iron on the map, and maybe someone else grabs before you get to it.
Mm-hmm.
So then you're like, okay, well, I guess I could grab one of the low irons, but that's a pretty bad tile. Maybe I should instead grab this, high aluminum here and this high carbon and instead go for electronics instead of steel, and I'll sell my electronics and just buy steel off the market.
And I was watching one of your Twitch plays before the cast, and I saw how you had to really make use of that because you didn't focus at the start on the materials you need to upgrade. You just focus on getting as much of the high-value ones, and you basically sold and bought your way to get what you needed. And I was watching, and I've been playing a few rounds of the game on Early Access, and it does really lend itself to a different feel compared to a traditional real-time strategy game. As we said a few minutes ago, a lot of people are comparing it to a board game and how its approach, even though it is real-time.
Yeah, it's tricky. I remember that game. I actually felt like I invested too much in the primary resources. Oftentimes people, they just want to make sure they grab all the good plots. But the thing about the primary resources is if everyone grabs water, carbon, and iron, and aluminum, they're going to be desperate to buy the more expensive resources. So they're going to be all selling these primary resources. And you'll look up and, water is selling for $3, right? Mm-hmm. You'd be better off not having wasted the claim on water.
Yeah. Now, one question I just want to clarify. When you buy a claim and you own that square, can you sell that square at some point, or is it forever yours, you cannot get rid of it?
Yeah, when you claim a tile, it's forever yours.
Okay.
You can, of course, delete the building and, change what you're doing. Like, every once in a while, you'll get some odd situation where, actually, in one of the games I played, you may have seen that, where I had a high silicon tile that was just a couple tiles from my headquarters, and the price of silicon just crashed. It was like $4 or $5, and I had a stockpile of 200 or 300, but I was instead desperate for one more claim to get oxygen and fuel, and there was no black market in that game, so I couldn't get a claim from the market. I couldn't afford to upgrade, so I just deleted my silicon quarry and put a electrolysis reactor on that tile, and then my headquarters automatically shipped some water to the reactor and then sent the oxygen fuel back home. And it was kind of odd that I claimed this high tile and I'm not even using silicon, but at that moment it was the best thing for me to do.
Yeah,
so that's another consideration when you're choosing where to claim. If you're only going for the high tiles, but they tend to be farther away from your headquarters, it reduces your flexibility.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if that high silicon had been all the way in the other type of map, other side of the map, it wouldn't have made sense for me to do that because it would have cost too much fuel to ship the water all the way out to that building.
Yeah. And it's really interesting to watch how the game plays, because it is very much not only economic focus, but it's also about logistics. Because one of the other things I noticed is that when you put different buildings next to each other, they'll basically conserve the fuel. There'll only be one transport needed, as opposed to having, three or four transports coming from one direction, wasting fuel, and in response, wasting your money.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot, and there's also an adjacency bonus. If you get two buildings at the same time next to each other, they produce 50% and 100% faster. Sometimes you get too many metal mines next to each other, and you're producing way too many flips. Mm-hmm. And, you're kind of overdoing it.
Now, one thing I also want to mention about Off-World Trading Company is how the game sort of changes when you shift into the mid and late game. When you start focusing on getting the labs, and as you mentioned a few seconds ago, what the black market is. So, could you talk briefly about how the mid and late game strategy sort of change with these buildings and functions?
Yeah, so there are a number of sort of advanced buildings that are really important that they don't give you much right off the bat, but they can really kind of pay off long term that you might want to think about. And the four core ones are the patent lab, engineering lab, the hacker array, and the off-world market. And the first two there are really like kind of your get your tech infrastructure. Mm-hmm. The industrial lab, the engineering lab, lets you kind of upgrade your production so you can get better water production or better oxygen production. You can upgrade each one of those things four times. Mm-hmm. And if you upgrade it fully, you'll be, I think, almost producing triple what you would otherwise. Mm-hmm. So it's it can be a huge increase. And sometimes it's almost too much of an increase because eventually, what are you going to do with all those resources? You know, you're just, if you sell them, you'll just drive the price to zero, right? But still, it can be very useful to upgrade, especially if you get a map where, you know, maybe there's only a couple sources of aluminum and you've got one of them and you're desperate for it. So you decide to just upgrade that, upgrade using the engineering lab. Then there's the patent lab. That has a bunch of sort of unique patents that you can discover that each do kind of these weird things like, teleportation means you can just sort of teleport stuff around the map. You don't need blimps anymore. Cold fusion lets you use water for energy, so you don't need power plants. Mm-hmm. What else? Carbon scrubbing lets you get carbon directly from the atmosphere. All these kind of slant drilling lets you like basically work mine a tile adjacent to the one you put your mine on. Mm-hmm. All these things that can really radically change the game. What's interesting about them is only one person can get a patent.
Yeah.
A lot of RTS games have these powerful technologies, but here you also have to keep track of who got what patent, how that affects the game. Then there's the hacker array, and that lets you basically trigger those surplus and shortages I mentioned earlier. And what's interesting about that is you don't know when they happen. You don't know whether the surplus or shortage is, quote unquote, a real one or a fake one, right? Like when you trigger it, the person who triggers it knows, but everyone else just sees food shortage, right? Mm-hmm. And they have to wonder, like, was that real or is someone else trying to, like, do something? You can make a lot of money off of hacker arrays, but you have to be really careful because you could end up helping your opponents more than you're helping yourself, right? Like, if you short food, you better make sure you're the only person on the map who's got food.
Yep, and if just to clarify for people listening, you can't see what your opponent's resources are, right? You can't see exactly how much food and all that. Okay.
Yeah, there's no real fog of war. I mean, it doesn't actually tell you how much they have in their stockpile, but you can. There's no fog of war, so you can go look at a column, and you can see they have three or four farms. You can kind of deduce that they probably have a lot of food supply.
And one of my last game really questions, I just want to ask you about what the black market is, because this seems like very much like the more of the direct interference that you can use against your opponents.
Right. Yeah. So this is the way to basically mess with other players. Mm-hmm. And I would describe it similar to like something like the robber in Settlers of Catan, where it's a way you can kind of try to take down the top player, but it's not something that's always available to you. It's something you only have limited access to, right? Mm-hmm. Like in Catan, you have to either roll a seven or you have to play the knight card, right? So in Offworld, there's a number of these types of sabotage. There's mutinies, to let you take over someone's tile for a certain period of time. Dynamite blows up their buildings. There's EMP, which will kind of knock out their buildings in a certain radius for a certain period of time. Mm-hmm. And you buy these items from the black market, but you can only buy basically one every minute. So you can't just, buy a whole ton of them. And plus, every time anyone in the game buys one of these items, the price goes up for everyone.
Okay.
And it's kind of exponential, so like eventually, it'll start at $2,000, but eventually the price will be like $100,000. So it doesn't make sense economically to buy, which means that, each item is probably only going to be bought four or five times per game. So that means, there's a limited number of times they're going to be used. So sometimes you want to buy those items early when they're cheap, just so that you're using them against someone else as opposed to them being used on you.
Cool. Now, I'm trying to think if there's any other design-related questions that are left, at least for right now. And as we said, the end game, or to finish things off, you basically have to buy out your opponent. Now, what controls the stock value of your opponent or your own stock value?
Right. So your stock value, first off, you have a certain base value that's kind of like based on the size of your colonies or any other colonies you own. And actually, if you mouse over the stock value, it will tell you this.
Okay.
And that first value is that sort of base value. Then it basically takes your cash, then it looks at all your resources, then it adds up, it adds your cash, mm-hmm. then it adds all of your resources. Like, it basically calculates, okay, if you were to sell all your resources right now, how much would that be worth? Mm-hmm. And actually, in that calculation, it actually factors in the fact that every time you sell the resource, the price goes down.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually doing the math of, like, okay, if I actually sold it, that's, you know, it's like that, what they always say about, like, you know, like Bill Gates, I mean, he has, like, he's worth $60 billion, right? But, like, if he decided to sell $60 billion of Microsoft stock, the price would plummet,
yeah.
right? So there's no way he could ever actually access the, you know, all that money he has. So mm-hmm. it's that type of thing.
Okay.
Then it also looks at your patents. They also have a certain value. And then it also looks at the stock you own in other people. And then it adds, that's also reflected in your stock price. So all those numbers kind of get factored together. Because if company B owns shares in company C, if I take over company B, I get those shares in company mm-hmm. C. So that's considered an asset as well. And I also should mention the debt. And the debt basically gets a multiplier, which means it's more important than the other factors. And that depends upon the difficulty level. But like if you're playing at the base level, it's a times three multiplier. And what that mm-hmm. means is basically for every $1,000 you have in debt, mm-hmm. you need basically $3,000 in cash to kind of offset it.
Okay.
So it's better to pay off your debt if you're worried about your stock price.
All right. Now, I know we're moving pretty quickly, so I have just one more general gameplay-related question, and then I just have a few regarding early access, and then we will wrap things up. So, my last gameplay-related question for you, Soren, is, for people listening who want to get into the game, and in terms of trying to learn it, are there any, like, major missteps you see testers or other people playing the game making that you could possibly illuminate for people who are just trying to get in and trying to learn how things work?
Well, I would say, I mean, go through the tutorials,
mm-hmm.
and early on, I would say try to diversify, you know, try to get a little bit of everything. You know, sometimes we see early players, they're like, they see a whole bunch of aluminum, so they, like, build four or five aluminum mines, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just too much, right? Like, eventually, there'll be, once you get to understand the game, you'll know when it's a good idea to, you know, overinvest in a resource, make mm-hmm. an unusual move, but early on, maybe try to be a little more diversified. That's a big one. The other one is don't be totally paranoid about debt. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to maybe be over $10,000 in debt. A little debt is not that big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because in some senses it's like maybe it's better that you're able to put that money into upgrading as opposed to like making sure you have no debt.
Okay, cool. All right, with that, we are moving pretty quickly. So my last topic then to talk about with you, Soren, is I want to focus a little bit more on the early access side of Off-World Trading Company. Because right. this is your, not only this is your first game at Mohawk, but this is your first game, I think, that you're designing in the early access space.
Right.
So, I guess the first question then is, what led you guys to put Off-World Trading Company on early access as opposed to keeping it internal and such?
Well, I really believe that you never really understand your game completely until you release it to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And that just as a more general general way to say it, I really believe that like the players eventually understand the game much better than the designers do.
Mm-hmm.
And the tragedy for a lot of games is you get that understanding when it's too late to do anything about it,
mm-hmm.
right? After it's already shipped. So to me, like that's why I thought it was great when I heard about how early access worked. It was this infrastructure set up to help you get this feedback when you can still do something about it. So, you know, we still have a year left to develop the game.
Okay.
And, you know, so that means we have lots of time now to look at what people think about the game and really think hard about whether we need to make some big changes. I mean, for sure, we're going to be making some small changes.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, right now we're, you know, there's a lot of people who have some issues with the game, with the way the game ends. They feel like it's a little bit abrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we're going to be thinking about maybe some alternative ways of doing it.
Okay. And to clarify for people listening, right now, if someone buys Off-World Trading Company on Early Access, how complete is the game in terms of, like, mechanics and systems?
Well, the core game is, I mean, it's definitely 100% complete. It's mm-hmm. only not 100% in the sense that we may change our minds once we start getting feedback from the players. But as far as the stuff we want to implement, it's mm-hmm. 100% done. You know, there's no music, you know, there's no matchmaking system.
Mm-hmm.
For example, like there's a whole online services thing that's going to come online, you know, later this year. A lot of the art and sounds are placeholder, mm-hmm. especially the voices. That's something we've gotten a lot of complaints about, but it's just really, that's just some like text to speech placeholder stuff we put in because we don't want to invest in voiceover stuff right now.
Mm-hmm.
Until like, again, we're sure what we wanted to say. The campaign is a little more of a work in progress than the, you know, the regular skirmish or multiplayer games. But, you know, it's at least at a point where I think people should play it and try it out and, you know, let me know what they think.
Okay. Now, you said that the mechanics and foundations are done for Off-World Train Company. Over the next year of early access, will there be any new thing like new resources, new buildings, or is all that pretty much, you know, hard set right now?
I mean, I'm happy with it right now with the number of resources and buildings we have, but, you know, I mean, you never know. I mean, we're you know, it's always, it'd be pretty easy to add something if we decide to make the game better.
All right. And one other question I also am curious about with Off-World and Early Access is the pricing. As we've seen, there's been a lot of debates regarding devaluing games and what's the right price to release a game at. And I know with Off-World, it's currently priced on Early Access at $36. And I was just wondering, for you, Soren, what was the decision behind the pricing of Off-World Train Company?
Yeah, well, we think our game is worth $40. You know, mm-hmm. we're providing a great experience and also like an innovative game that you can't there's not something else quite out there like it, so I think that mm-hmm. that makes it worth its money. You know, I understand there's a lot of people who out there who think that that's more than they like to pay for the game right now. Mm-hmm. And you know, I understand that, like that's fine. I'm not really pushing people to necessarily buy Off-World right now. Like, if they feel like that's too much for an early access game for one that's not finished, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I definitely, you know, I just encourage people to basically just keep tabs on the game and, you know, check in with us when we, you know, when we finally release the game. You know, I think it'll be a great product then, and it'll you know, absolutely, I think everyone will say, you know, without question, it'll be worth $40 then. And, you know, as for right now, you know, I mean, there's some people who are excited about going along the ride for early access and, you know, being able to you know, engage with the developers while the game is still, you know, under progress. But, you know, I totally understand that there's people who don't want to do that as well.
All right. And to clarify for those people, will Off-World Train Coming remain at $40 when it's released, or will the price go down once it's finished?
Oh, no, it won't go down. It's okay. $40 is the final price.
Awesome.
I mean, there'll always be sales and whatnot, but, like, mm-hmm. that is our target retail price.
Awesome. All right. I think with that, we can start wrapping things up. I know this is a short cast, but I know Soren is a busy guy. I don't want to keep him too long. And this is one of those casts I think we could just sit here and talk for like 2-3 hours if there wasn't any time restraints.
Yep.
So my final question then for you, Soren, is for the folks listening, do you have any final thoughts or anything you would like to say to the fans?
Well, first of all, it's been wonderful hearing all the support people have had for Off-World. We've really gotten a ton of positive feedback on it. People, what's been really heartening is hearing how many people are excited about playing something different. Mm. Because that's the thing we feel like we're often struggling against as game developers, is how hard it is to, you know, make a game that really is unique. So it's been exciting to see just how much the fans seem to want that.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And for those listening, now, you also do weekly plays off Off-World Train Company, right, on Twitch?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, every Thursday at 3 o'clock Eastern Time.
Awesome. Again, I wish we could talk longer, but I definitely want to have you back on at some point, because we definitely need to have a general discussion on strategy game design. Who knows? Maybe I can get John Schaefer on. We could have that epic strategy game discussion.
Sure. Yeah, that'd be fun.
Awesome. So, with that said, we're going to wrap things up for the Perceptive Podcast this week. As always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. For guest pieces and being future podcast guests, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. And to contribute to our ongoing Patreon campaign to get monthly funding for the site, you can find all that information under the Patreon banner. And definitely make sure to check out the Game Wisdom Twitch channel and our YouTube page. The Twitch, you can find my channel under GW Bicer, and YouTube, just search Game Wisdom. I live stream and talk about games I play. I've been doing Darkest Dungeon. I may do a little bit of Off-World Train Company too in the future. Make sure to check that out as well. So, thanks again for tuning in. Have a great rest of the week, and I will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.